Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2011. Lecture 18, delivered on November 2, 2011. The title of this lecture is Break-Even Analysis.
Today, break-even analysis. Before I do break-even analysis, I wanted to give you a real-world example of degrees of leverage, so that you could see this in practice. Here you see for the financial statements, these were drawn from Edgar. I didn't pull Edgar up, I just pulled Yahoo's repeat of Edgar up. But you'll see income. You'll see the income statement of Costco, income statements for the last three fiscal years of Costco. I want to caution something that is actually still a mystery to me. And I've been asking some accounting jockeys what's going on. Depending upon where you go for financial statements, something really weird is going on with the financials. In many places like MSN and other places like that, you'll see that they're saying there's no interest expense. It's all zeros. And I see this over and over and over again, but then when you go to the 10K filings, you find, yeah, there was interest expense. And I'm not sure what that's all about. But here, I'm pulling from Edgar itself, so you'll see the real McCoy numbers. Now, how you deal with it. Remember I told you before that you see a formula in a classroom, and then you see real financial statements, and sometimes things aren't exactly the same on the financial statement. Names and entries are not exactly the same. And there's a little bit of that here. Now remember, when you're calculating degrees of leverage, you're going to need three pieces of information. The percent change in sales, the percent change in EBIT, and the percent change in net income. You get those three pieces of information, and then you'll be able to do the degrees, the degree of operating leverage, which is the percent change in EBIT over the percent change in sales, the degree of financial leverage, which is the percent change in net income over the percent change in EBIT. And then finally, the degree of combined leverage, DCL, is a percent change in net income over the percent change in sales. Now, with taking Costco here and pulling the actual information, we'll do the 2009 to 2010. First things first. You'll see that revenue has a net sales and then a membership fees going down to total revenue. But the formula says percent change in sales. So we have to figure out, what are we going to use? Are we going to use the net sales numbers, or are we going to use the total revenue numbers? Talk to me. Which would you use in a situation like this? Mumble at me. No, talk. What do you see? What would you use? Use your judgment here. Which one would you use, net sales or total revenue, for that number, percent change in sales? Total revenue. I would. The reason there is that although that membership fees line isn't that notable, it's enough that I probably would like to include it because they seem to rely on some membership fees. You notice that it's about... Really, it's less than 2% of net sales, so it's really not going to change anything. So I'm just going to throw it in there, and we're going to do the percent change in sales off the total revenue line. And so we would have 77,946 for a percent change in sales. 77,946 less 71,422 over 71,422. And that'll buy me my percent change in sales number. And hammering that out, and do make sure you can do this yourself. It's better if you do it with me, especially if I make a mistake. 946 minus 71,422. All of that divided by 71,422. And as a percentage, we had a 9.13% change, positive 9.13% change in sales 2009 to 2010. Now, the percent change in EBIT would be which line? What line is that? What is EBIT when you see it in financial statements? They usually don't call it EBIT on the financials. What is it? Operating income. So I'm going to say, okay, operating income went from 1777 to 2077. So I'll have the percent change in operating income is 2077. Is that right? Minus 1777. All divided by 1777. And if I honk that thing out, 2077 divided by 1 minus 1777. Oops, wait, let me clear that. 2077 minus 1777. All of that divided by 1777. I get 16.88%. So we can already see that there's magnification of volatility going on. You see it? See how the EBIT line is change is magnified? Now we work it down to the percent change in net income. And I don't know. I just go to the last line, net income attributable to Costco in this case, which would be 1303 minus 1086. 1086, all divided by 1086, 1303 minus 1086, all of that divided by 1086, no, 1086, and I get 19.98%. Okay. There are the ingredients. And that's, by the way, when you will get one of these on the exam, I promise. And so your strategy, get those things first, and then it works out a lot faster. Okay, percent EBIT over percent change in sales would be 16.88% over 9.13%, which comes out to be 16.88 divided by 9.13, 1.85. Is that right? Yeah, 1.85 times. And again, that's a factor. It's an X times. Percent change in net income divided by percent change in EBIT would be 19.98%. All divided by percent change, 16.88%. 19.98% divided by 16.88% is 1.18. And then times, and then your degree of combined leverage, percent change in net income, 19.98%, divided by percent change in sales, 9.13%, will come out to be 19.98 divided by 9.13, 2.19 times. Okay. So in other words, the volatility of sales magnifies more than two times by the time you get to the net income line. Whatever change has happened in sales, the change is more than twice as strong at the net income line. The question then is, where is that magnification coming from? Is it coming from a balance or what? Now, that's where we use the identity, the DOL, degree of operating leverage, times the degree of financial leverage, is the degree of combined leverage. So I know that 1.85 times 1.1, what is it? Let's do that right here. Is that right? Yeah, 1.85 times, I did that right. 1.85 times 1.18 times equals 2.19 times. Now there'll be a little bit of rounding error in there, so it wouldn't come out exactly right. Talk to me. What is causing the magnification of volatility for Costco? What is causing it? Come on, what do you say? Anyone got an idea? Because I will ask you this on an exam. Go ahead. Actually, their financing is not. Look, that's a very small, almost nothing. What's driving this, that big magnification there, is being driven by operating leverage. What causes operating leverage? What is it that creates operating leverage? And why does that make sense here with Costco? What creates operating leverage? Do you remember? It's fixed costs. Now talk to me. Someone give me an idea here. Matter of fact, I'll ask you, what do you say? Why does that make sense with Costco? Why is its volatility being caused by fixed costs? No, that's variable. That's variable. What is it about Costco that makes it a fixed cost animal? What is Costco? What is it involved in? Wholesale. Okay. What is it about wholesale that makes fixed costs a big thing? It has to have stores, hard brick and mortar things. It can't exist in cyberspace. It can't exist at some computer geek's computer terminal. It requires lots and lots of hard fixed assets. Fixed assets in brick and mortar buildings, fixed assets in trucks, distribution, all kinds of physical capital, things that are fixed in their expense. You pay them whether you have great sales or low sales. This is a company that is anchored on the ground. This is not a company like, for example, a Google. Well, Google's getting worse that way now. But you will find, interestingly enough, that companies like this, most of their volatility magnification from sales down to net comes from the fact that they are brick and mortar operations. And so you will see their magnification mostly right here. As far as financial magnification goes, that is minimal. Their interest expense is not causing much a magnification of volatility at all for them. That is true of, again, many, many companies that do things like wholesale, retail, distribution, that kind of thing. Now, here's an interesting thing. Why would you possibly expect a Google to look somewhat like a Costco with an imbalance toward DOL in the degree of combined leverage magnification? Why would a Google have DOL larger than DFL? Is there some logic behind why that might happen? Yeah. Hardware, you're getting to it.
Servers.
Yeah, there. Not just servers, server farms. I mean, we're talking things that are as large as you could imagine, huge server farms. Every time, have you ever gone to Google just to find out how to spell a word? Yeah. You are destroying the earth, assholes. You are firing a server farm. And it's going to work for you, snapping and twitching and blinking and farting somewhere on another part of the planet. Those server farms are hardcore, just like you said, they're hard assets. So even sometimes when you think about something that's a cyberspace company, it still has to have a lot of hard fixed assets behind it. And so don't always think, well, this DOL is going to be small if it's a cyber company. Not necessarily. It depends upon what kind of a cyber company it is. For these companies that run these server farms, you would not believe how much energy those things use, how much physical space they take up. They are big, big things. And, I mean, this is one of the things that will amaze you is, you see a lot of companies have you heard of something called Energy Star and these certification programs that your company is real energy efficient and all that? Well, you know what's funny about that is that any company that is heavily involved in internet work of any kind, whether it's an investment company or a lot of other kinds of companies, they cannot achieve company-wide energy efficiency certifications. And the reason, what they do is they get sector certification. Everything in the company is very energy efficient except for that big, big room or that three floors right there. Because in those three floors or in that big room is where their servers are running. And those servers are just energy hogs. I mean, they are snarfing energy. And so companies find it that they cannot, if they have servers, IT, a heavy IT footprint, they can't achieve overall energy efficiency certification because of that mass of fixed operations. And that translates also into where their income, their magnification comes from in terms of volatility from sales down to net income. They have a lot of fixed assets, huge fixed assets. It's something that you kind of give it a thought, and when you're also running it, working in a business, and they say, all right, we have an awful lot of magnification. We're not comfortable with that. What can we do about it? In some cases, the answer is, well, we can do something about it. But at the same time, in some companies, that's just the way it is. That's just the company itself has to be that way. You'll see that it's just that in some cases, in fact, in some cases, because you've got all these fixed assets here, that requires capital financing. A lot of times that's capital financing. Capital financing, you got two ways to do it, equity or debt in general. Here's the problem with that, though. You've got to have the fixed assets, which bring up your degree of operating leverage. But you have to finance those capital assets. If you finance them with debt, which is cheaper overall, at least at first, that's going to bring up your DFL. So you've got this twin monster that you could end up in a situation where your DOL is already high because your brick and mortar, a lot of capital assets, But then to finance those, you're using debt because it's cheaper, but that brings up DFL, so your overall magnification goes through the roof. That's why you'll see some companies moving towards equity in their capital structure rather than debt, because in the long run, they make the decision that their optimal capital structure is as much based upon not wanting magnification overall to be terrible against the weighted average cost of capital. In other words, if I finance with equity, that doesn't cause DFL to go through the roof because the interest expense isn't there. Even though debt is cheaper than equity, if I finance with debt, I've already got DOL high, DFL goes up too. So I move towards equity, even though it's more costly, because in the long run, moving towards the equity takes away some of the risk of volatility magnification. You got what I said there, I'm impressed. It's just one of those parts of the decision-making process that we have to think about. We don't really want sales movements to cause massive changes at the net income line. We really don't want that in general. But we have to have some, if we're capital asset-based, intensive, we're going to have DOL high. So that means that we have to control DFL. And how do we control DFL? By moving away from debt, even though it might be cheaper. At least equity doesn't cause DFL to go through the roof. And therefore, we control DCL through the capital structure of the company. That, in other words, the mix of debt and equity that we use for financing projects. Enough of that. I'm going to take that off, all that, kill all this. This just gives you one of those nice little things that you can look at with companies and get an idea. It's one of those measures. It's a cheapo measure of risk, measuring the magnification of volatility from sales down. But it's worth having a look at, especially if you're just thinking about some quick investment thinking, okay, what kind of magnification do they have? That's sort of a measure of overall risk, not necessarily non-diversifiable risk. Let me kill this off here real quick here. Oh, mother's work is never done. Log off. Okay, system off. Well, that sucked. Yes. Thank you. Now, moving on to break-even analysis. I gotta find someone who really works for the you. It works. We've gone back 60 years. Okay, 50, 60 years. We're back in the late 1950s. The world is black and white. It was back when I was a kid. I mean, we were so happy when we started seeing Bonanza in color. We didn't have a color TV, so my dad bought this thing that we were supposed to put on TV that made it so that it was color. Didn't work. Anyway, we're back in the Andy Griffith Show. Okay? Now, you probably don't remember the Andy Griffith Show. That scares you. See, that just pisses me off. But back in that time, small town America was the place to live. You grew up strong. You found out about sex the old-fashioned way with the farmer's animals. Watching them, for God's sake. No. Sicko. Yeah, and when you went into town, you shopped at the grocery store, the little grocery store. And, of course, you got your hair cut at the barber shop in town. And they really did have the candy stripe kind of poles, and you went in there, and it was a very cool place. Except that there's something, as I think back, How could that barbershop possibly have survived? How could the town barber have made a living charging $2 for a haircut? He might do 10 on a busy day, 20 haircuts a day. How could anyone live doing a business like that? I mean, it's all about high markups, volume, all that kind of stuff. None of that was there. And yet, these kinds of businesses survived, and they proliferated across the American landscape from the late 1800s through until probably early in your lives, when they began to vanish from even smaller towns. But they did survive. How could that possibly work? Were the cost of living that much less back then? Well, sort of and sort of not. It goes to a key part of the idea of break-even analysis. You see, when I'm working on doing economics kind of business stuff, I would explain to the economics students, and of course I know you didn't have me as an economics professor, but you should have, you would have learned so much more, that total cost can be divided into your variable costs and your fixed costs. You were planning, who is this going to be? Yeah, you. You were planning a business life, working in some big company like State Barn here in town, and that you wanted to be a captain of industry, but you weren't happy. That wasn't what you wanted. You got the job, you got the big money, but something was missing. One day you finally say, no more, I'm leaving. You wanted to do dried flower arrangements. Now, I've talked about this before, and I want to encourage you to live your dream, and you are going to. You left. You sold your house. You shot your dog, and you said goodbye to your children. Please join the Insane Clown Posse, Juggalos. And you went and moved into an Airstream trailer in the middle of the desert, where you did dried flower arrangements. Now, obviously, there would be two costs involved. You would have the variable costs that would change with the number of units. The flowers, the baskets, and obviously the nice oils that scented it and the ribbons to make it very nice. But there would also be fixed costs involved. Among them would be when you went to places to sell them, you would have to rent a booth. The rental would not vary with how many you sold. So there would be a fixed cost involved. And every operation, production, has both fixed and variable cost. Now, put simply, I can say that the variable cost is some price per unit V times the number of units Q sold. That's a little bit simplified because that variable cost could change. It could get worse as you produce more, but we'll say it's just a fixed amount here. And then there's this fixed flat money that you're just going to have to spend. Okay? So the bottom line is, well, okay. So our profit, which is the price times the quantity minus your total cost, actually boils down to price times quantity minus the variable cost per unit, the Q units, plus the fixed cost. Putting that out into expanding that out, the profit is P times Q minus V times Q minus FC. Okay. How many units do I have to sell before I am breaking even? Clearly, those fixed costs are going to have to be a hurdle. I'm going to have to overcome those fixed costs before I'm making a profit. So let's ask the question, where is break even, which is this output, which is essentially where is the quantity where profit equals zero? So I would say zero equals P times Q minus V times Q minus FC. And I'm going to solve for the Q. The first thing I'll do is put the fixed cost over on this side, on the left side. And then I'm going to factor out the Q. And so fixed cost equals quantity, the break-even quantity, star. And I should put a star on that because that's a special quantity. That's the break-even quantity. Star, Q times P minus V, the price per unit minus variable cost per unit. And so I find that my break-even quantity is going to be the fixed cost over P minus V. There's an old style term for P minus V. I don't recall whether the book even uses, our current textbook uses the term. We used to call P minus V unit margin. And you'll hear me use that term, unit margin. It's the per unit price minus the per unit variable cost. And it represents our spread between the cost and the spread between how much we can sell it at minus the variable cost per unit that we make it at. Now, notice something kind of interesting here. Your break-even output is going to go up as your quantity, as your fixed costs increase. The heavier you are laden with fixed costs, the more seriously you are going to have to produce to be able to break even, given a P minus V. So that would mean that if you have lots and lots and lots of fixed costs, you are probably going to have to produce a lot of what you sell, unless you've got a massive margin, unit margin, P minus V. But assuming that P minus V, you are constrained in what you can do on that, well, you know. Now, I want you to look at something here. This P minus V, again, that's called unit margin. The wider that gap is, the less you have to sell to break even. The bigger your unit margin, the less you have to sell to break even. So in other words, you want your price as high as possible compared to your unit variable cost. That's easier said than done in a competitive market. You are constrained in how much you can charge for your product simply because there's competitors out there. Now you try to accomplish something around that through what's called marketing. Trying to get people to believe that your product is so much different from your competitors that you can justify a higher price. In other words, in order to widen the unit margin, you have to make people believe that your product is worth a big price compared to how much you make it for. That's the entire point of marketing. It has nothing to do with whether a product is good or bad, worthy or unworthy, different from the competitors or the same. Marketing is about how much you spend versus how much price you can mark up to get people to believe, because people believe that your product is different. So we have all the marketing in the world revolves around creating as much spread as possible between the price unit price and unit variable cost. And again, it's all about making people believe, because belief is what's going to drive their purchasing decisions, whether or not something actually is different or not is irrelevant as hell. I consulted for companies. One of them actually had an unbelievable battery. It was unquestionably better than any battery on the market at the time. But that didn't matter, because they were up against the goddamn Boom Boom battery. And all that mattered was that that stupid fuzzy bunny with that stupid ass drum won every time. And so if you want to be really cynical about it, which I really encourage and I will really care about you, don't try to sell the product on its qualities, its real qualities. Sell it on fear. Sell it on desire. You see, because what I'll do to you in watch marketing, because it's all about making a price, that unit margin, as large as possible. Your variable cost for making products is actually going to be fairly low. The variable cost for me to make a picture, a 17-inch by 11-inch, is about $5. I've got to get people to believe that having my picture makes them better people. Just like, for example, let's take something like Oil of Olay. Oil of Olay is going to make you look younger. It's going to keep your skin fresh, because if your skin isn't fresh, you're going to get old, and no man's going to love you. You're going to die alone in your apartment, and your little poodle's going to eat you, because no one cares about women who are crones. Budweiser is the king of beers. Remember, they say there is no other one, because if you don't get Budweiser, you're not going to get big horses and a big woman. You got to get a Ram truck. We know what Ram means, don't we? Honk, honk, nudge, nudge. Oh, you get a Toyota, what'd you do? Get it pink? Got a Nike swoosh. You better have a Nike swoosh, because, you know, if you don't have a Nike swoosh, you know, you're not fertile of loin. You know, yeah. It's okay, man. You know, if you want to be that way, I mean, I don't. And I know a lot of guys don't. But I use guys in the real sense there, you know. See what we're doing? We're trying to get that price up. And it has, that's absolutely necessary in order to bring down break-even. Break-even output level is going to be a bitch, because the higher it is, the more you have to crank out. And remember that the more you crank out, the more your marginal cost of the last unit is going to go up. That's something you should have learned from economics. Every last unit you make is going to cost you more than the unit before it. So as your break-even quantity goes up, your total cost is going up disproportionately faster. So we have to make this unit margin as wide as possible, in order to sell, in order to market our product and have a break even that's low. Now, I want you to notice something here, interestingly enough. If I were to mark profit and I were to graph, where the hell? Okay, profit, and I'll write the equation right here. Profit equals the price minus the variable cost times quantity, all times quantity, minus your fixed cost. Isn't that right? Yeah. Okay. So if I were to graph profit against output, that's a linear equation of the form y equals mx plus b. Remember from your dark days of algebra. Look what that means. Grr. Where the hell are we? Oh, there. Look what that means. That means that actually the y-intercept is negative fixed cost. So the profit line is down here at negative FC. And as the line goes up, its slope, the rise over the run, is P minus V. The slope is P minus V. And the place where break-even occurs, Q star, is that FC over P minus V. That's Q star. Right there, the break-even point. So notice, unit margin is another way of saying the slope of the profit line. Unit margin is the slope of the profit line. So if you want that slope to be steeper, pull this way so that your break-even quantity is lower, you need to make this number bigger. So in other words, if I wanted my break-even to come in from Q star 1 to Q star 2, I would have to make P minus V go up. I would need to make the price minus unit variable cost go up. I'd have to increase that margin there. Alternatively, another way I could do it, and I'm just going to draw the line again, the profit line again here. Negative FC profit against output. Another way I could do it, leaving P minus V unchanged, would be to lower my fixed cost from negative FC1 to negative FC2. Because if I lowered my fixed cost, I could keep P minus V. I wouldn't have to make P minus V some stupidly large number. This is how mom and pop operations survived in old times, is because each one was a small company with a small fixed cost. Most of their cost was variable cost. And what they did was they didn't need to produce a whole lot, make and sell a whole lot of what they did, because their fixed costs were relatively minimal. Most of their costs were variable costs. And so as long as they kept a certain margin between the price and the variable cost, they could run a business like a barber shop on 10, 15 haircuts a day. A drugstore on maybe $100 in sales a day. Or a hardware store selling to maybe 30 customers in a day. This was how it was done back in that time, in the small town kind of environment. But even back in that time, the big stores were starting to show up, the chain stores. What they did was they simply overwhelmed the model, larger fixed costs, but they kept their margins tight, but they had to sell a lot more. As a matter of fact, it was so severe the way it was damaging the markets back in the 1930s that there was a law passed. It was an amendment to the antitrust acts that had come in the decades before, trying to stop the proliferation of these large chain stores. It was called the Robinson-Patman Act, otherwise known as the Chain Store Act, because these large-scale stores were simply blowing away the mom-and-pop operations. Because they would go national, they'd have to sell huge amounts, but in any given market, they had to sell very little. So essentially, they were like a multiplicative version of the small town stores. So for example, a Dollar Tree. A Dollar Tree would have to clear, maybe one Dollar Tree would have to clear maybe $30, $50 a day. Clear, $30, $50 a day. Because if you have 5,000 of those, then in any given day, you have just a staggering amount, $150,000 cleared. Over a year's time, millions of dollars. So in the model that was the chain stores of the early days, they just multiplied the model, and they just knocked out. And then they could even tighten their margins. And so they would win over the mom-and-pop operations. And I'll show you what I mean by that. So you had a single mom and pop operation going like this. It would need only a small amount of output to survive in a given day. What the national chains did in the early days, and they still are pulling it to this day, is they will narrow P minus V. They'll actually shrink that so that they are shallower, but each of their stores is a real cheap affair. They need to sell only a little bit in any given store because their stores are such cheap-looking things. But then you multiply that times thousands of stores that do the same thing every day, and they will destroy the small town stores because they have actually shrunk the margin on P minus V. They lower P, V stays pretty much the same, and so they can underprice the mom and pop operations in towns, and then they essentially overwhelm the market because they're making millions of dollars every year because they've got so many of these operations working at any given time. This is the successful model of Dollar Tree, Dollar General, some of the other earlier stores that did the same trick over the years. Walmart, to a certain extent, does the same trick, except on a mega, massive, stupid scale. But again, there was actually a law against this going on. It was never enforced. And of course, now in this time, you don't see many of those mom and pop operations anywhere in the United States. Okay, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.